Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, this is Dick Staub, and I'm live from the International Arts Movement event in New York City, where we have had a veritable feast of riches of artists and writers and poets and dancers, and we've gotten a chance to kind of celebrate what it means to be engaged in the generative, creative arts, is how we've been talking about it. And certainly the highlight for many of us during this event has been the involvement of our next guest, who comes all the way from Dublin, Ireland, to be part of this event. He's Michal O'Shiel, and in just a minute I'm going to spell that for you so that when you look him up in Google, you'll be able to actually find his work, because I know you're going to want to pick it up. He was educated at Trinity College in Dublin, the University of Oslo. He's a full-time writer. He has published 12 collections of poetry. He was awarded an Irish-American Cultural Institute Prize for Poetry in 1982. In 1998, the Martin Prize for Literature. His collections include The Gossamer Wall, Love Life, and Globe. And let me reassure you, they're all available online so that as you hear these, some of these poems read over the next few minutes, you'll get a chance to go and pick them up yourself. It's so good to have you with us, Michal.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's lovely to talk to you too, Dick.
All the way from Dublin, Ireland. Born and raised in Dublin?
I was born and raised in Dublin, though I spent a fair deal of my youth in the West too, which was a very, very influential time for me and influenced, I think, a lot of my life.
What clues were there in your childhood that you might have an interest in poetry or words or language? I mean, were there little clues when you were a child, when you were a young boy, or was this kind of a late blooming thing?
Oh no, I think I've always loved words, and I fell in love with poetry when I probably was about 8 or 9 in just simply in primary school. I can remember the poems were poems read for us in the class, and I just thought this was pure magic, and nothing ever since has ever come near to that magic.
Do you remember any of those early poems that you were hearing, that you were, the words were striking you, or the sounds, or the images, the metaphors?
Oh, absolutely. I do, of course. I do. And the poems that maybe now I wouldn't think poems that I would want to, you know, say are my favourite poems or anything like that, but I do remember the rhythms. I do remember the excitement, and that was what really set me off. That was the touchstone for my life, really. Hmm. The Laburnum, which my brother on his birthday set. I mean, what a wonderful line like that, you know. I remember the house where I was born, the little window where the sun first came peeping in at morn. I probably misquoted that, but you can hear the rhythms in it. Yeah. You can hear the excitement of it.
What was your earliest poetry? Were you writing in school? Mako is here, and one of the things that I noticed in reading Mako's little biography is a teacher noticed when he was young, and in a public school in the United States says, you don't want to be waiting or wasting God's gift, do you? And he said, can you imagine that in a public school? But the point was, he had something that a teacher saw. Were you kind of writing poetry and people noticing this?
Well, I certainly was. And then, of course, I went to a school which James Joyce was at, and which is described in the Portrait of the Artist, Clongowes. And I had the great fortune, good fortune there, of having a teacher who left the school to become a full-time writer, Tom McIntyre. We parted ways in many ways afterwards, but it made it possible for me from the very start to think of that as something to do with your life. And I had really decided when I was 12 or 13 that was what I wanted to do with my life.
What attracted you to poetry as opposed to fiction or essays?
I love fiction, I love drama, I love things, but for me, right from the start, it had the combination of rhythm and music and thought. It brings all of those things together in a way with an intensity. I think probably, and that's a temperamental thing too, I have a very intense temperament. If I had been born in, you know, I used to go to the piano as a boy when I got frustrated, but I hadn't got the musical tradition to be that. So it was words. My father had a terribly, terribly sharp tongue. He was just a murderous tongue with words and so on. So from right from the very start, the way you do...
In what sense?
Well, he could cut you apart. He cut you in two with his tongue. You know, he was ferocious. He was actually a frustrated lawyer. He would have loved to be a lawyer, but he was born with one hand, and that was in the country in those times, and that was regarded as a blemish, they wouldn't let him become a lawyer because they thought he mightn't succeed, and they sent him off to boarding school at five. He wasn't let home for Christmas because they thought that would be too soft for him, and so forth. But he developed a tremendously powerful tongue, and he was a great reader. He was an extraordinary man to read. I remember he took his holidays to read Tolstoy's War and Peace. That was he had all levels of everything from country town Irish to the highest sophisticated English. So I was fascinated by words from the very beginning.
For those of us outside of Ireland, it's hard for us to distinguish whether Ireland makes the writer or the writer makes Ireland or what the mix is. My first time in Dublin was probably 26 years ago now. And I remember going to a pub and overhearing the conversation. And there was poetry reading and there was singing and there was... And I felt like, oh, well, no wonder they create such great art. Just the sound of the words and the... As you've had a chance to travel abroad, you've lived abroad, what is it about Ireland and what is it about the language that... that comes alive and makes the potential for a poet so kind of profound in that country, in that place, in that tradition?
I think there's a number of factors involved. I mean, first of all, you've got to remember that we were colonized and that we didn't have the bourgeoisie that would support, say, painting and music of the classical sort. So you had... what survived really in the colonial circumstances was a traditional music, and also with that an oral culture. And with oral culture goes talk. I mean, the only thing you can do when you don't have money is talk. So I think, you know, you're not going to be able to paint, you're not going to be able to have big orchestras. So talk is it's an oral culture. On the edge of Europe, remember, it wasn't industrialized until very late, you know. Also, remember that folklore survived. In other words, a world culture survived on this edge of Europe for a long, long time. I mean, Finland is the second greatest collectors of folklore. I mean, it's obviously now it's a very different Ireland we're talking about, but this is the Ireland I grew up in. It's now a very, very different country, and it's changing vastly in these things. But also you've got to remember that there was a language shift, which I also think brings a sort of hybrid vigor to things. I've spoken Irish since I was a child as well, because I was in the west of Ireland, though I spoke English in my actual home. But that change of language, of a whole population learning another language, I think brings this, as I said, hybrid vigor.
When your father could cut you with words, did he go back and forth between English and Irish? Is there kind of a fusion and blending that happens in that?
No, he didn't do that. But what he did do was he used the various registers of his English. And the register of his English, which was country town, would slaughter you. But he also had the most extraordinary... Latinate and learned vocabulary as well. So it was an extraordinary combination, yeah. Really. You know,
when you your work has been compared to jazz, and you actually find jazz kind of an inspirational way of thinking about your work. How did you get exposed to jazz in Ireland, and what was it about it that started to connect to you that you were resonating with?
Well, my exposure was limited, but though there are, you know, some very fine jazz musicians. I had the great pleasure in my 60th birthday last year of having Happy Birthday played by Louis Stewart. And apparently when Benny Goodman arrived at Dublin Airport, the one thing he said was, "Where's Louis Stewart?" So there was a sort of a tradition of jazz, but it's actually its metaphoric power is what fascinates me. You see, it seems to me to be the perfect image for our times, because first of all, I'm fascinated because it came out of suffering. It's a music born of suffering originally. It's the gaiety which has been purged by suffering. You get the same sort of thing in Eastern Europe with klezmer music out of the Jewish thing. And of course, you get it in Gaelic music. Out of the famine Ireland came this extraordinary repetitive exuberance of Gaelic music. It's an amazing quality. But what I have always loved about most in jazz is the improvisational character of it. It seems to me that they take the most banal tunes and then the riffs they play on it and so forth. And so it seems to me, see, everything we know in all ologies, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's chemistry, you know, whether you're talking about physics, whether you're talking about genetics, you know, the whole thing is you can describe, but you can't predict completely. And jazz seems to me to be the wondrous way of expressing that, that you take the ordinary and the banal, and yet within it, there's something that is going to generate a new excitement, an improvisation, an innovation, something that's provisional.
Now, as a poet, the idea of improvisation is really interesting to me when I think about poetry, because poetry, if it was created in a live venue and people were watching it, the improvisation would be different than the poet sitting alone in a room. And yet I noticed yesterday when you were reading your poetry, it was like jazz. So the poet has to capture the improvisation in a very disciplined environment, which actually is true of jazz too, by the way. I mean, jazz is very mathematical, and it's very...
Yes, I mean, I actually quote a clarinetist who once says, the moment somebody starts to play with me, I know if they know where they're going. I know where that music is going, and I know he knows that they're more confident, we're away.
Yeah.
The precision of jazz is the most extraordinary precision, but the precision of poetry is the same.
Yeah. Could you read us one of your poems that does bring jazz into the picture? It's titled Given, I believe.
I'd be delighted to do that. It's the opening poem and the theme-setting poem, if you like, for this book called Globe, which is dealing with the whole changing of the globe at the moment and taking jazz, of course, as a way of seeing how we have to adapt, to readjust, to change, to fit in, and yet taking with us that sense of continuity that jazz also brings. Here it is, Given. Duke Ellington's It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing juggles a gene from within a phrase. Newness takes wing. Our human being 1 second in 3 years. As an atom to the planet, our earth in space. A single offbeat in all that jazz of spheres. Still, somehow, the player's nerve to chance it, even to love a humbler in-betweenness of non-stop becoming, to flourish in transit. O world as it is, and not as it might have been, our riven map of this cussed here and now, where webs and clusters of movers again begin to allow the to and fro of things to arrange and rearrange, while another bridge passage prepares tomorrow's loops and modes of change. For all our lines' fragility, still dream-driven, as shifting landscapes shape and are reshaped, our one precious second, our globe as given.
Wow. Here's the thing I noticed yesterday in your reading, and again right now, the rhythmic sense of your poetry, the musicality, the tonality, the rise, the fall, there's motion in great poetry, and that's obviously true of jazz as well. And it's fascinating, again, for people that can't imagine the work of a poet, somebody will say, well, good grief, I mean, it's only 20 lines of words. And, you know, you could bang that out in 10 minutes. They have no idea what it takes to craft something like this at every level, including this kind of musicality. What's it going to sound like? How are the words going to sound?
Every word in a poem has to pull its weight. And, of course, as I said earlier on, what I love about poetry is, I mean, good prose does have rhythm. There's no doubt about that. The best prose has rhythm. But you can allow the langueur. You can allow, you can allow yourself. That's what you can't import. Everything, every moment, every second, every word has to be tense and hold that intensity like on a string on a bow, And if you lose that, you've lost the poem.
Man, we could spend hours talking about that. You and I are both children of the 60s. It's hard to use the word children of us anymore.
No, I'm afraid we're getting a bit long in the tooth for that.
People could see us. They'd say, here's a couple of boomers deceiving, deluded again. They somehow can still imagine themselves as youth. But how did the 60s affect you and your work and your thinking and your writing and the themes that began to emerge in your work?
It's strange because the 60s, it was really after the 60s that I began to see where I was going, because the 60s was a very confusing time. It was an extraordinary time, and you had all those Penguin books that came out with sociology about everything, and I read everything and thought I knew everything about everything, in fact.
Who needs Stephen Hawking and a theory of everything? We already had it.
You had it, there's no doubt, and we knew how to fix everything. But suddenly the 60s... faded, and the 70s came, and there was a sort of a sense of almost disillusionment of settling down, and I had to learn something which was nearer wisdom than know-allness. That was the 60s, and the humility again, the humility of knowing how little you really knew, and to allowing to actually to becoming a conduit in a strange sense, not trying to demand to be the know-all, but rather to allow life speak through me and to learn that humility. I think that was
what's interesting about what you were saying is you and I were commenting about political campaigns and the rhetoric and how if you really... They say if you remember the 60s, you weren't actually there. But the dim memories we do have of the 60s, we remember a lot of words, a lot of rhetoric. And in a certain sense, language was cheapened. And the ballast and weight of language was lifted because there were so many words and they were so hollow. Which in a sense should have created a greater sense of value for poetry. Whereas you say every word holds its weight. If it's tempered with wisdom... It brings us words that can be trusted. I mean, so did you get a greater passion for poetry as you began to, and for words and the importance of crafting ideas that would stand the test of time as a result of the 60s?
I suppose I did to a point, but I mean, the 60s was a breaking, there was a lot of... There was a lot of silliness, actually. I often think of them as the silly 60s, because we in our know-allness and in our, in a sense, and all that sort of flabby thinking, and it was flabby thinking. The flower power was lovely, but it was flabby. And we didn't actually understand how the polis works, how a society works. And of course, the next generation was the gopher generation, which just despised the silliness of the 60s in many ways. I think it was the realization of that, and the realization of the need for continuity as well as just breaking away that came to me in the 70s when I really felt I was coming into my own and finding myself.
One of the things about every artist's work is it definitely changes according to the season of life. And so, your work now, Globe, and the poems included in there really are about changing and the way things change and shift, and you kind of recalibrating yourself to some new realities. And you have a poem in Globe, and again, folks, these are available online. And let me take a minute to spell the name here. For those of you listening in the United States, the first word is spelled like Michael. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's almost.
Yeah.
It's Michal, and it's M-I-C-H-E-A-L.
Right, so yes. I was going to say, the difference between our Michael and the way his name is spelled is the E-A-L. Then the last name is O-apostrophe-S-I-A-D-H-A-I-L. And so when you go to Google or you go to Amazon and you want to order the books, if you're listening to the podcast and you don't have words in front of you, you go to O-apostrophe-S-I-A-D-H-A-I-L for the last name. And, of course, you can go to thekindlings.com and just link to the book page from there. We're going to now listen to Miho and the poem Change. Well, our footprint, I'm sorry.
Of course it is about change and so forth, and also this sudden feeling where you were talking about the 60s, that you suddenly 40 years have turned, like the turn of your hand, and you realize that another generation is in there, and you're in a sense we're on our way out, you know, and it's handing over to another generation, and it's both overwhelming, all this extraordinary exciting technological change, but also in some ways frightening, that you know that our past may be something that they won't even be recognized. Footprint. Sometimes ground vanishes under our feet as tidal waves of change sweep in so fast over sand, too shifting now for any retreat. But neither fogies nor spirit wrappers of a past, all thumbs, slowly we text our mobile tidings, cupping on to GR8 and CU at 3. The only rule of thumb to learn new things, as our middle voice tips towards passivity, allowing another generation show us how to program memories and delete what's old or out of date. As making way, we bow with grace to let another crowd take hold. Even in the thrill and confusion of letting go, strange continuities in this thumb tic-tac, a sign from school or invoices, so and so many at such and such, makes a comeback. Yet also, some unease lurks in the marrow that those who follow may thumb their nose at footprints we walked in. Once numinous traces rubbed out by history's ebbs and flows in the sifting sandglass of our remembrance. Under their thumbs, one global city they build. Their turn to find loops and detours of advance, keeping promises we're leaving unfulfilled.
One of the themes that you see in your work is learning the lessons of history. A lot of your work is really around understanding what it means to be human. Reflections on the Holocaust and in other ways that you, you're looking at the scope of history and understanding we stand on the shoulders of those that have come before us. When you think about the events in history, as you look back on them, that you have found yourself drawn to, most profoundly, what would they be, and why do you think those are the ones that are touching you as deeply as they do?
Well, my last book was Globe, as you've pointed out, and prior to that I wrote a book called Love Life, describing 35 years of being in love with the one woman. But before that, that's a third book ago, I wrote a book called The Gossamer Wall, Poems in Witness to the Holocaust. And that was a book which I had been reading about the Holocaust for years, but I devoted 4 solid years to doing nothing but thinking and reading the witnesses from the Holocaust, reading about it, reading Holocaust literature. And I tried to distill as best I could the story of the Holocaust in one book of poems. So my answer really is that I think the Holocaust is the most extraordinary event. Now, it's not that it's not a question of whether there was ever a genocide before, and obviously there's been, God knows, Rwanda was taking place when I was actually writing the book, and that awful word ethnic cleansing was coming up and so forth. But in some ways, it's a paradigm for us in Europe. Mm-hmm. I was drawn to it, I think, like all things, a decision to spend 4 years of your life devoting it to something. It's made on different levels. It's made on an intellectual level and it's made on an emotional level, and I think the two come together. The intellectual level for me, if you like, was that I felt that what had influenced all my youth, what had cast over all my intellectual youth, the Holocaust had cast a shadow because the faith in humanism had been broken. And so I grew up with existentialism and so forth. And there was, and then afterwards, when I had come to a different point of view, there was still deconstructionism was going on. There was all sorts of ways of undermining, actually, a culture of suspicion, if you like. And I wanted, I'm not satisfied with that culture of suspicion. I want to actually, I believe in the end, on balance, one has to trust. And to do that and to write the sort of celebratory poetry which I was writing, I felt I had to face the greatest evil that I knew, one that had cast a shadow over not only over our century, but it probably was one of the most awful events of the millennium. In its calculatedness, in its absolutely uselessness, insofar as it was a culture taking its best people and destroying it for no reason whatsoever. There wasn't even gain in it. It was the heart of cultural Europe. It was Bach. It was, it was Goethe. And also, you know, to think of it, of the first 13 Nobel Prizes for chemistry, 11 were German. You could do no subject. You could study nothing without German. And yet, out of the heart of Europe, this terrible thing came. I also believe that we hadn't faced it as a culture. The world had to get on with being, the survivors had to get on with so people didn't talk, they knew what they wouldn't be listened to, people couldn't have the time, they had to get on with the world. So I felt we hadn't faced up to it, and if you don't face up to that tragedy, it's more likely to happen again. But even more so, I was fascinated by what I call the 60-year gap. It's an extraordinary thing, but I was born 2 years after the war. And in order for the story to go on being told, to being remembered, it has to be told again by another generation, my generation, mm-hmm. but also while there are still survivors there, to be able to say, this rings true or doesn't. Yeah. And I've had one of the most extraordinarily moving moments in my life was reading from that book, The Gossamer Wall, Poems of Witness to the Holocaust in London, when a woman who'd been through Auschwitz came up and threw her arms around me and said, "You have spoken for us all." Mm. And that was just an extraordinary moment for me. And I genuinely believe that, you know, that you have to, that story has to be told. It's when I say the 60 years, it's an extraordinary time. You know, the Waverley novel started with, it was 60 years ago. Mm. But also Tolstoy's War and Peace, which I mentioned earlier, my father reading, 60 years after the Napoleon Wars. They reckon actually that probably the New Testament was written around about 60 years after Christ. That generation coming after has a perspective on it, which the people that are so close to it don't have, actually. And yet they're in living contact with the memories.
When Steven Spielberg talks about doing Schindler's List, he's still at the Academy Awards this year, it is 2008, talks about it as the highest, most crowning achievement. He felt kind of a burden lifted from him, that as much as, like you, he had to focus on this darkness day after day, that he was able to kind of find some personal sense of redemption and cleansing by getting it out there. How sobering was it to spend 4 years in that world with that heaviness? And what did it feel like when you said it's finished and it's now to be sent forth?
The extraordinary thing that came out of it for me was that I went through it because, as I said, I wanted to be able to write the sort of celebratory poetry I write and still say I have faced the greatest evil. I'm not avoiding this. It's not an easy lyricism, an unearned lyricism. So I came out of it, but actually I came out of it with some hope for humanity, because the extraordinary thing is, and this is no justification and it's no simplification of it, but in the belly of the beast, in those camps, in the worst of all circumstances, still there were glimpses of humanity, of love, which are just in the very heart of evil. So that gave me some hope for the future and for humanity. So that was very important to me. But mind you, when I was finished, if you asked me how I felt, I then turned and wrote a book, which was a celebration of 35 years of love. And I think I needed to do that after the Gossamer Wall.
Spend some time thinking about love.
Yes.
You were raised in terms of kind of your exploration of the transcendent, you know, understanding what it means to be fully human, but also trying to kind of work through how transcendence fits in relationship to human. And you're raised in a very religious culture in which it's just kind of woven into every aspect of cultural life. In a certain sense, I remember walking into a church tradition completely different from mine with my father one time. And I was very enamored of this tradition. And we walked out and he said, just remember, familiarity breeds contempt. And the thing that you were familiar with, you now have contempt for. And this new thing you find yourself attracted to. But then he kind of reflected on it. It's important for you to face, you know, what you came from and determine what the good and bad of it is so you can move ahead. How did you sort through all of that in your own life and in your kind of journey around issues of transcendence and against the backdrop of a very religious country?
Well, I'm glad you're using the past tense because Ireland is getting to be extremely secularized. The test of it was, somebody once said to me, you know, in the 50s, everything seemed to revolve in Ireland about religion. In the beginning of the 21st century, everything is about money.
Yeah.
America,
Andy Warhol said, money is more American than thinking.
Well, I'm afraid that there's a big grain of truth in that. No, I mean, I was brought up in a very traditional and Catholicism, a very narrow sort of Irish Catholicism, which it was. But on the other hand, I'm it's imagery and it's imagination. I'm very grateful for it. I was a child of the 60s and of course had to reject all of that for a while, but I'm so glad that it has colored my image, my whole mind and my imagination. It's a wonderful, even to think of an image, say that I have a poem about an airport and I talk about people, as they go and somebody takes out a handkerchief to cry and they wipe the face of somebody into that handkerchief. Of course, I'm thinking of Veronica, and the Ver icon, that image, to have that in you as part of your background is a great richness.
Yeah, this morning we had an artist whose work is at the Met right now, and she said she was grateful that she wasn't in a museum that was like a mummy, and she was referring to kind of the deadness of a lot of museums. And in a certain sense, whatever religion tradition we're in, it becomes the mummy unless we move kind of beyond it, and we go to new places.
Well, what is the name of that man who did the stages? Kohlberg was the man who did the stages. The poor man, I think he committed suicide in the end. But he talks, about going through different stages of development. Some people never reach the top. I'm afraid I may never, ever, ever aspire to reaching the top level of maturity. But there is something, about you have to go away to come back. I think there's you. In other words, that you some things you take by osmosis, but I think unless you actually reject and come back, you haven't appropriated. You haven't made it your own.
Mm-hmm. You in your book on love, 35 years of love with the same woman. Mako, in his book, tells the story of coming to a place of spiritual crisis that he defined as the question, how do you love your wife if your most important priority is art? And you and I talked about that briefly, and your wife has Parkinson's, and you're a man who loves this woman, and to date, your art is able to occupy a central place, but your reflections on love when you began to work through all of that, What kinds of things did you begin to explore and see about love in from the perspective of a poet and an artist?
Well, I suppose I've always known it was a ménage à trois. There's me, my wife, and the muse, or maybe the other order, I'm not sure which. I have the most wonderful, loving, and understanding woman. And in fact, I think that the greatest gift probably an artist can have is to have a partner who understands the ménage à trois, and knows the selfishness of the artist, understands that the terrible unhappiness if you don't do what you have to do. You mentioned that my wife has Parkinson's, which she has. She's a wonderful soldier. She's extraordinarily brave and she carries on doing everything. But I haven't really been in the crucible yet because she's still able to do most things at a slower pace and at her own pace. So I haven't been put through the crucible of having to choose between the two. But she's always understood with me and known that I would be a very unhappy person if I wasn't writing poetry.
Mm. You wrote a number of beautiful pieces on love, but one of them is titled Ceremony, and I'd asked you to read a bit of that.
Yes, well, if I may just preface it with a few remarks, it seems to me that it's so easy, I think, in a permanent relationship to fall into just the dailiness of it and so on, and the tic-tac of the dailiness, and to forget the courtship, which was the original excitement. And I'm always fascinated, if I may quote Tom Lehrer, the comic, in his wonderful comment when he was asked on the radio in Dublin, in fact, you know, about his Jewish background and so on. And he said, well, he was an agnostic. And he said the worst thing about being an agnostic was that he said, I think he said he was an atheist. And he said the worst thing about being an atheist was that he didn't get any days off. But then he suddenly added to it, he said, but it's even much worse to be an agnostic because you don't know whether to take them off or not. So I've always believed in this business of leisure and pleasure, so that to try and pull back and remember the joys of courtship. Ceremony. I want to remember Friday evenings. We dressed up just to go nowhere and carefully laid a table for us both, pretended we were each other's guest and host, as we lit a scented candle, wooers tending the smallest need. We talked as though we rarely met, allowing ceremony undo the hex of everydayness, of half-said things, what we should have heard but missed, as if round and routine both bind and cast a spell we need to break. We date, we dally, playing court to broach the Sabbath of ourselves. Slow repetition of sober days, an actor's lines over and over till every twitch of the tongue obeys. Sluggish mornings, a struggle to cope, tumbling, tumbling acrobat behind the smiling dancer on the rope. Scaled hours against the flow, a pianist's years of finger drills before the encore and the low bow. Hell, high water, thick and thin, gain and build up of steady pace, a refusal to give up or in. Slack, accelerando of covenant, strange freedoms of discipline, pirouette in the glory of an instant. Acupoint of joy. Harnessed catharsis, everything new and possible again, an old actor's glow. All for this. Bird flight at sundown. Afterwards, the aftershine. Infinite moment.
Wow. Well, you've heard some selections this afternoon from Love Life and also from Globe. and a marvelous piece of work. How would you define, in conclusion, what you believe your sense of calling is to be a poet? What is your task? What's your work?
I'm going to use a terribly old-fashioned word, and I'm going to say that I think it should be to be a prophet. And when I say a prophet, I mean not an old man with a grey beard or somebody who can tell you who's going to win the next horse race. What I mean is somebody who lives in the present moment but is preparing in the present the future. In other words, is taking the present and finding the images which open up the future to us. Mm. In that sense, I think that the sacredness of poetry is in many ways to be a prophet.
Boy, well, you know, after you read yesterday, the first thing I said, prophet, philosopher, poet. Because as you were reading poetry yesterday, and I'd read your poetry, but I'd never heard you read your poetry, and I had this kind of sense of a prophetic presence. The ability to see, to hear, and then to create metaphors and images through carefully selected words and tones and order and sequences, and so that we can also see. And it's beyond seeing or hearing the words. It's the sum is greater than the whole of its parts, or the whole is greater than the sum of its parts in a good poem. There's something transcends out of the words and poem that is bigger than the poem.
Not only that, but I would say, you know, when I use the word prophet, I use it with extreme humility, because actually I think as an artist or a poet, I think I'm a conduit in some ways, that life passes through me, and the most I can do is to try and keep the instrument in tune.
Hmm. This has been a most fascinating conversation with our guest, Michal Oshiel. Let me spell the name again. It's like Michael, except E-A-L, and then O'SIADHAIL. Go to thekindlings.com, and you can link directly to his books, and I do hope you'll pick up a copy of these. Or if you're listening on audio, just go to Google and put in O'SIADHAIL, and enjoy beginning or continuing the journey that you've begun in this conversation with Michal. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for interviewing me.